Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Audio Road. Welcome to Trends in Technology. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Lisa Campbell is your producer and call screener extraordinaire. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show where we explore what's going on in the trucking industry. It's a mix of new products, new services, and new technology. We'll also bring you expert guests from all areas of the industry, such as Bruce Mallinson on diesel engines and performance, and Mike Beckett on tires and alignment, as well as many others. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in with your question or comment. It's up to you. This is your show. Once again, welcome to Trends in Technology, and here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember, to talk to Kevin, press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your call. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome to Trends and Technology. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. I'll be here for the next hour taking your calls and answering your questions. If you're listening online and you want to join us on the call right now, the phone number to dial 347-884-8327. We do have some lines open. If you're on the call and you've got a question, a comment, a topic you'd like to talk about, whatever it might be, press 1 on your phone at any time. Lisa will screen your calls, and we'll get to those here in a little bit. No guests tonight. You have to put up with me for the entire hour. You know, I still think that most of the industry is recovering from Louisville, the Mid-America Truck Show. At least the vendors are. It's a tough show. It's a lot of work. We're tired. So we decided I would just kind of wing it tonight on the show. I've got a lot of stuff I want to talk about, what's going on with some new technology we're working on, some stuff that really hasn't made it to the show quite yet. If you've got anything at all, tonight is open lines. We can talk about whatever you want. So go ahead and line up those calls, and we'll get to them here in just a little bit. First off, quick roundup, wrap up of what we did at the show this year and what we've got going on and coming up in the near future with truck technology. This year at the show, we did something a little different. Last year, we had the signature truck. The signature truck was everything I knew about fuel mileage and maintenance cost and lowering all the cost of operation. And it was all proven technology. There really wasn't anything on the signature truck that hadn't already been proven to improve fuel mileage and reduce operating cost. It had never been put on one truck at one time, but everything on the truck was pretty much proven technology. We've built many of them over the year. We're tracking several of them. They're all doing fantastic on fuel mileage. So this year, rather than just build another signature truck, we decided to build some concept trucks with some ideas of new things that we were working on going forward. The biggest one being the W9 that we had there called Slick, the truck built by Jones Performance. And the idea was we did the aerodynamic improvements to the truck, but we really didn't do anything else to improve fuel mileage. What we wanted to do was see if this was just a pretty average W9. I mean, it's, you know, 355 gears, no wide singles, no low rolling resistance tires, a couple of Bruce's parts on the engine, but no real improvements in the drivetrain or anywhere other than the aerodynamics. So it's pretty comparable to a lot of W9s that are already out on the road. We're going to put the truck to work, and we're going to see what the aerodynamic improvements did as far as fuel mileage. Then we're going to use that truck because we'll be running it with the driver in it in fairly controlled situation. We're going to start testing some newer technology that we haven't really worked on before. At the same time, I'll be testing some of those technologies on my trucks here in Florida, and we'll kind of let you know what's going on and how things are working out. And there are some things that we're going to be doing with those trucks that I'll be talking about tonight, and then there are some things that we're still not even ready to talk about. We'll kind of let you know as we go throughout the year. My goal is to get enough good hard data on some new technology that sometime in the near future, maybe not for Dallas, but maybe even for Louisville again next year, to build the next generation of Signature truck with even more proven technologies on it. And that was part of the reason for Lisa and I coming back to Florida, was to be closer to the trucks, to get our trucks back in shape, get them back up to a good solid baseline on fuel mileage so that we could start testing some of these things pretty aggressively. And that's what we're doing now. Trucks are pretty well stabilized. We've got a good baseline on fuel mileage, and we've started already testing some new things. One of the things we're testing on our trucks, one of them here in Florida, we're testing hydrogen injection again. And it's a newer system. The bugs are worked out, or so we're told. I tested hydrogen injection last year. Well, I guess it's been longer than that. It's been over 2 years since the last time I tested it, and it didn't work for me last time. If you listen, you probably know I'm not a big believer in the technology the way it stands right now. I do believe that hydrogen gas will improve combustion and could improve fuel mileage. The reason I don't think it works in the real world on a Class 8 truck is because it still takes more energy to produce the hydrogen than we get in improvements back out of the hydrogen. And I think that's what we're seeing. If you're on fuel gauges or if you're on the website, you can see the results of the truck we're tracking. We're tracking it in real time. Every time the driver stops and fuels up, I put the fuel receipt in that day, and you can see some of the results. And just to give you an idea, back in October when we got to Florida, this truck was doing about 6.1, 6.2, somewhere in that range as far as fuel mileage, but there was a lot of stuff that needed work done. The charger cooler wouldn't even hold any pressure, so we put a new Duralite in it. The truck no longer had synthetic in it, so we put the new OPS Echo Pure on, switched back to Valvoline Premium Blue Synthetic. It still has the Bridgestone Graytech wide singles, so I know we're taking a hit on fuel mileage with those. We'll be switching back to the new X1 XDA Energy soon. The overhead hadn't been run in a while. The truck was really in, it had also been turned back up somewhere in the 68 to 70 mile an hour range. So we turned the truck back down to about 62, fixed all the things that were wrong with it. I drove the truck for a day after we got everything back in shape just to prove what was possible with the truck. And at 57 miles an hour with me driving the truck, I did 8.2 for the day. Now, the running average from October till just a couple weeks ago, even with those all the months of getting it back up to shape, we're at a running average of 7.28. That was the long-term average, including when it was getting 6, before we installed the system. The last fuel up right before we installed the system was 7.5. And the truck's been within that 7.5 range for the last 30 days. It varies by about 3/10, down into 7.2 range, up to 7.8 and better on some days. And that's a pretty tight range, 3/10 variance in either direction. So with the hydrogen system on, the last, about six fuel ups, I guess, let me go through some of the numbers here. We did 7.5 right before we put it on. The next tank after was 7.66. That's not even 2/10. So we're still within that 3/10 range. The fill-up after that was 7.53, right about where it's been running. The next tank was 7.23. Again, not anything significant. We're in that 3/10 variance up or down. We did have a good one after that, 7.87. Again, within the, you know, a tad over the 3/10, I thought maybe we might start to see some improvement. And the last fuel up, which actually was, then we did a 7.34. Again, we within that range and no significant improvement. And then there was actually a fuel up on the truck today. It was 7.48. So we're going to continue to test the system. I need to get over and verify that the voltages are right and everything's working. The driver tells me it is consuming water, so we believe it's on and it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. I just don't think we're going to see any fuel mileage improvement from this. I'm also trying or getting ready to do a test of propane injection, and I kind of feel the same way there. I feel like the cost of the system, the cost of the propane, is going to offset any increase we might see in fuel efficiency. But I've never tested propane, so I want to get that done myself on one of my own trucks. Some of the other things we're looking at, some of this comes from the truck show. You know, as we're building these concept trucks, I'm trying to seek out the very best people I can find in each area. And when we built the signature truck, that's what we did. You know, we have Fitzgerald Truck Sales that has been building glider kits for decades. Bruce Mallinson and Pittsburgh Power build our engine, and there isn't anybody that knows more about diesel engines. Western Truck Parts did our drivetrain. Row Truck Equipment did our lift axle, Row and Fitzgerald. So we had a really good team to build that truck. One of the things I felt like we were missing was somebody who could help us do even more to improve aerodynamics, which we got with Jones Performance. They're a custom fiberglass shop. They can build anything we can imagine just about. And also, I felt like with some of the aerodynamic changes we've been making to the trucks, we needed to design a new air intake system. That was part of redesigning the hood on the W9 and on the show truck, the way it was at Louisville, we had cowl induction, but we don't really believe that that's going to be the best way to do the air intake. So one of the companies that I've been talking to and looking at their technology, I had them on the show a couple weeks ago. I actually had them on the show over a year ago, and that is Fleet Air Filter. And I got a chance at the show finally to meet David, who runs the company, and what a great guy he is. He's another gearhead, sprint car racer for years and years, and anything you can think of, this guy can fabricate. And, you know, he's been working on the Fleet Air Filter technology, which is a washable foam filter. And I was really interested in that technology. So we started working with them. And he's gotten so excited about that whole concept that not only is he building the elements for those filters now, he's also designing the housings. Now, originally, he was taking his element and building it over the original housing. Well, now he's actually flow testing some custom housings that he's designing that are directing even more airflow into the intake. So when I put him together with Rod Jones from Jones Performance, and he's also a dirt track racer, sprint car, and those two got together at the truck show, and it was just amazing to watch those two and to see the ideas start coming together. So they are both working on some pretty cutting-edge stuff when it comes to air intake. We're trying to create the very best airflow with the best filtration, and I think this is one of those areas on a truck that has been really neglected. even the Vortox air cleaners, as much as everybody talks about how great they are for air intake, we're finding that they're not as good as everybody thinks, and we could do a better system under hood. So that's part of what they're working on. We're also playing around with the foam filters themselves as far as density, how thick they need to be, how much airflow we're getting on those. So that's pretty exciting. But again, nothing like this has really been tested on a Class A truck. So that's why we're using the concept truck to do that. While I was working with Fleet Air Filters, I also came across one of the things that I did was, you know, I got talking to David and I said, look, you know, we've tried to improve everything on the truck so far that we can think to improve that will either improve fuel mileage or lower cost overall, maintenance cost, whatever it might be. And with his racing background and all of the other things he's done, I just asked him, I said, what am I not doing? I went through everything so far that we're doing on trucks, engines, drivetrains, tires, aerodynamics, airflow, you know, air intake, air exhaust. I said, what am I not doing that might be available out there that you've seen? And he said that what they've done on their race cars that made a huge difference was they found a guy who can make full ceramic bearings, and that he can make them in any application, whether it's an internal engine bearing, whether it's a gearbox bearing, or whether it's a wheel bearing, making them out of ceramic. And he said it lowers the rolling resistance or the mechanical drag inside that component significantly. And not only that, because the ceramic holds up to heat so much better, they're able to run, instead of a 90-weight gear oil, a 40 or 50-weight gear oil on a ceramic bearing. Now, at the truck show, it's the first time I've even been introduced to the idea. But it's one of those things that we're working on moving forward, and that's the kind of technology that we're looking at. So I know nothing about that, but David tells me that this company can build a bearing in any application. So I'm going to be talking to them soon and maybe doing some tests. We will be testing some new air intake stuff from Fleet Air Filters on our trucks here within the next month. And again, we, you know, with three trucks, I'm going to try to maybe stagger some of the things we're testing on each truck. One of the changes we're going to make to all three trucks coming up within, well, the product is being shipped as we speak. We should have it in the trucks within the next 2 weeks, maybe even shorter, and I'll start to give you some results. And this is a product that I talked about a year ago, and I've done as much research as I can possibly do, and now it's time to test the product because I really do believe in it. We also got a chance to meet them at the truck show and to set up the test, and that is Evans Coolant. If you remember when I talked about it last year, if not, I'm going to go over some of the reasons why I believe in this product and this technology, and we should have some results on this coming up pretty quick. And Evans Coolant is the only coolant on the market that is truly different from every other coolant. Now, coolants for me, you know, just a year or so ago, I was confused about the whole green, red, purple, blue, polka-dotted coolants. I had no real idea what the difference was. So we went out, we found some experts on it, I did all the research, and then I got it. And what it turns out is that every coolant on the market is a blend, usually about 50-50 or 60-40 glycol and water. It's some mix of glycol and water. Every coolant on the market. Doesn't matter what color it is. It doesn't matter if it's long life, extended life, super duty life. I don't care what they call it. Every coolant on the market is glycol and water. The only difference is the additive package that's put in. The old style green coolants have an additive package that needs to be recharged on a pretty regular basis, and that's why we had water filters. Wasn't there to filter anything. That was the recharge kit for the additives. Well, on the newer trucks, when they did away with the water filters, they did it because you should be running, the newer truck, you should be running an extended life coolant that doesn't need the additive recharged. That's the only difference, though. The additives will last 500 to 600,000 miles, and then you could just replace the coolant at that point. But it's still glycol and water. The weak part of that being water. Water boils, water freezes. Glycol helps some, but not enough. And that's why we have to pressurize the cooling system to bring the boiling point of the coolant down. And pressure in and of itself causes a lot of problems. We don't need a pressurized cooling system. The only reason we need it is because of the shortcomings of the coolant itself, the water. We have to pressurize it so that it doesn't boil. The pressure causes problems itself. So when I looked at Evan's coolant, the only coolant on the market that doesn't contain water, it is a different form of glycol. You can't run pure glycol in a cooling system, not the way we know it. It won't work. We have to mix it with water. Evan's found a way to use glycol in a different state, a different form, and take the water out of the equation. The hard part to get your head around with this, first of all, let's just talk about why it's better if all we do is take our current coolant out and we put Evan's coolant in, and why it's better. First of all, it protects much better against heat and freezing, and we don't have to pressurize the system. That alone should minimize a lot of coolant system problems because we no longer have any pressure. We won't get hot spots in the engine. The radiator becomes more efficient at cooling, and we can it's also a lifetime coolant. There really aren't any additives, per se, to break down in this coolant. So you could put it in once and be done. It will go a million miles plus. So there's some real benefits to just putting it in the system. No cavitation. No cavitation in the water pump. No cavitation in the liners. That's another big advantage. Now, I got looking a little deeper because Evans did some SAE testing on fuel mileage. And they did it a couple different ways, and they were showing some pretty significant results, or what I considered pretty significant, for a coolant. In one test, they showed a 3% improvement. In another test, they actually showed an 8% improvement in fuel mileage. That was what really got me interested. Here's how they do it. Because the coolant is so much more efficient, they run the engine at higher operating temperatures, which improves efficiency and performance. When we run a diesel engine hotter, they run better. Problem is, we can't protect them at those temperatures. With this coolant, we can. But that's the claim, and that's what I'm going to work on. So once you get the coolant in the engine, then what we do is we put in hotter thermostats, and we change the fan on settings in the ECM, so that the fan doesn't come on till higher temperatures. Two advantages. The engine's running hotter, so it's more efficient. The fan's not coming on as often, so we don't have the horsepower and energy drag from the fan. So that's Evans coolant in a nutshell. I've done a lot of research on it. I'm pretty convinced that this is a good product. But now the real testing begins, and that should be in the trucks, like I say, within the next 2 weeks at the outside. I'm thinking that probably not this Monday, but the following Monday is the day that my trucks don't run, and we'll probably be down in Orlando at the shop to do that process. I want to be there, maybe even get my hands dirty and jump in, and there's a procedure for getting the old coolant out of the system, drying the system so we get all the water out of it, and then putting the new coolant in. So that I think that's just about everything I've got on my list. I see that we've got some questions, and I'm going to get to those. If you want to jump in with a question about anything I just talked about, comment, new topic, whatever it might be, press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will get right to you. Let's start off in Colorado. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I got a question about an auto shift an 03 Freightliner.
Okay.
And the test or the light's coming on, the service light, and it won't shift from fifth to sixth. And there's no codes kicking out.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, and I want you to definitely get this looked at. But what I'm finding, and I just went through this on mine. Now, mine had over 1 million miles. How many miles are on yours?
It's got about 1 million.
Okay. Mine actually turned out to be mechanical. We went through all the electronics. We went through the ECM. We went through the actuators, everything that could possibly be causing it externally on the transmission, and we couldn't get it fixed. And we ended up just putting in a remand auto shift. We just did that a couple weeks ago. So,
okay.
You know, get it in, go through all the easy stuff first, you know, make sure it's not something electronic or external. But ultimately, if it's not, then the only real thing you can do is tear the transmission down. And I just figured at that point, I was just going to put a remand in.
Okay. And so this doesn't, it's not doing this all the time. It's done it a couple of times. And I drive it for 20 miles at 20 miles an hour, you know, trying to get to a town. And then all of a sudden it would snap out of it and start working again. But,
well, believe it or not, mine did that for almost a year. And during that year, it only did it like 3 or 4 times in the year. And the driver would call me and say, hey, look, here's what happened, but it stopped doing it, and now it's shifting great. So I'd say, let's take it in. We'll get it looked at. Nobody could see anything. So we'd say, well, you know, it's working. Let's drive it. And, you know, then it started happening, you know, like once a week. And finally at the end I said, look, let's just get a transmission in it and stop screwing around with it.
Okay. Well, I'll change the solenoid, and I was going to rebuild the piston in the back. They said the two things that, you know, a few $100 to do that. So we'll see what happens.
It's worth it to try those first. And see, that may take care of it.
Okay. All right, well, thanks on that. And one other question is, I got a financial question. I was leased to a guy here, and this I first started out last September, and I was leased to a guy. And he had the insurance coverage. And so I was not a rider. I wasn't on the policy. My truck was. So I wasn't getting any of the correspondence from the insurance company, and then I started researching and finding out that I could, you know, I could get on it. But then I paid the last month and got my own authority and went out on my own. But the insurance was canceled on the 8th of January, and I had paid it up till the 28th. So he owes me money.
Okay.
And this guy will not answer my phone calls. He's still putting trucks on, running his company, and he won't. And it's only a few $100, but it's just the principle of it.
I know.
And the only leverage I got on this guy is the whole time I was running for him, he had absolutely no safety program. No, he was not in a drug program. He's a cowboy, and he's running the company without having any kind of compliance with DOT or FMCSA.
Right.
What do you suggest? Do I just walk away from it? Do I threaten him with turning him in, or is turning him in, would it even do anything? Taking him to court is, what am I going to get?
Yeah, it's not worth that. So what it really comes down to is do we walk away and just say, you know, there are always going to be people like that in the world, and I'm happy I'm not dealing with them anymore. Or do we, like you said, turn him in? I mean, really, you know, the reason for turning him in is more vengeance than anything else. It's not like we're clean up the industry by turning these kind of carriers in. I guess you could threaten him with it to see if you can get some money out of him. If he doesn't respond to that, I would probably move on. I've been in this position before, and any time for me when it's less than like $1,000, I don't put a whole lot of effort into people like this. Because we end up getting more wrapped up into it. You know, you get more angry, and then you kind of escalate, and then you still don't get any satisfaction, and you get more angry. And a lot of times I just look at this and go, you know what? The $400 or $500 or $600 just isn't worth it.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of where I'm at with it. I just wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah. If you wanted to just hit him with a registered threatening letter that looks really legal, and I might even – I was just looking today. FMCSA just came out with the new – I hadn't seen this before. This is pretty new. Now what they are saying is it's only going to take one safety audit from FMCSA that discloses any significant safety violations, mostly hours of service, and they are going to mandate electronic onboard recorders for that carrier. They used to say – their old stance was when they – came out with this ruling not that long ago, is that it was going to take two unsatisfactory audits over a two-year period. Now they've changed that. They said one. They come in one time, carrier has significant hours of service violations, and they're going to mandate EOBRs. So maybe you send him a threatening, legal-looking letter that even references, that article from the FMCSA and see what he does.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks. I could try that. And then if it doesn't work, I'll just
move
let
on.
It go, So
Yeah. It's not worth it. Like I said, if I thought we could actually clean up the industry and do something about carriers like this, it might be worth it. But you know what? They've been around forever. I don't even see, CSA 2010 cleaning up any of this stuff. So let's go to Texas this time. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, Kevin.
You're welcome. What's on your mind tonight?
On the hydrogen theory that you got, are you going to use external hydrogen or create your own hydrogen?
You pretty much have to create it on board.
Yeah, that'll never work.
That's kind of what I think, too. And what confuses me, I guess it doesn't confuse me, I'm just kind of baffled as to how many companies are still producing these hydrogen units. And these things aren't cheap to make. I know you can make them in your garage, but the unit that I've got on here is really well-designed and well-made. This thing wasn't just thrown together. This is a really nice, high-quality unit. They put a lot of money and a lot of effort into designing and building this thing. And I'm kind of baffled because when I look at this, it just looks like logically we're just not there. We can't produce enough hydrogen on board without sucking so much energy from the engine that at best it's going to be a wash. So why do all these companies keep pushing it and producing it?
Yeah. You ever heard of the Michi Okaku?
Are you speaking English?
I'm trying to.
Okay.
His website is Mkaku, K-A-K-U.
Okay.
He's a theoretical physicist. He works with string theory, whatever that is.
Okay.
And basically, you got a dollar's worth of energy. There ain't no way you can make $1.05 worth of energy. It's impossible. It's physically impossible, as far as our, top scientists can think right now.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I see this. Now, I know they're theory is that it's not the energy they're trying to get out of the hydrogen. What they're attempting to do is pull more energy out of the diesel by improving the combustion. Now, the problem I have with that is everything that – yeah, and catalyst is the wrong word. They use catalyst all the time, and propane injection uses catalyst, and that's wrong. Because catalyst means that we've changed the chemical compound of something, and you can't do that. I mean, propane doesn't change the chemical compound of diesel. So catalyst is the wrong word, and they all use it. But, you know, everything that I read about modern electronic diesel engines says we're already in the high 90% as far as combustion. So there's only a couple percentage points to squeeze out of there. And if we have to put, you know, propane systems on and injection systems on, there's not enough to get back out of this equation, the way I see it anyway. Maybe I'm missing something, but, you know, I just don't think it's going to work.
I think you're on the right track with, you know, better bearings and better aerodynamics under the truck and better side skirts on the trailer and, you know, air tanks, you know.
I'm glad you mentioned trailers because trailers are, and that's something we haven't talked about a lot, but I think there's huge room for improvement in trailers. And in fact, this weekend, we're going to be talking with Landstar. And one of the reasons I want to bring them on and talk about it is because I like their business model. If I go pull for Landstar, I can choose whether or not to have my own trailer. And I can't do that with a lot of other carriers. And I think as an owner-operator, we're missing a huge opportunity for savings because we don't control the trailer.
Yeah, most of the time your worst trailer tire is on the, you know, it's
absolutely. Yeah, we've done that for years. I mean, we always put our worst tires back on the trailer, and that's the most important position. All right. Well, good stuff. Good talking to you. Let's see. We've got other calls to get to. If you want to join us, go ahead and press 1. Lisa will screen your call. We'll get you here on the air. Let's go to Washington. Bill, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. Hey,
hello there.
I've got a 99 Pete 377 with a 3406E with a 13-speed transmission.
Okay.
It's got tall rubber on it, 24.5s.
All right.
And it's got a rear end of 3.55.
Okay.
And what I want to do is drive it 55 to 58 miles an hour. Well, in January, we put brand-new wheels and tires on it, which were high rubber again, and the box one with caps on it. We put Brickstone BDRWs with rolling resistance of 186.
Ouch.
Yeah, ouch. So oh. I called them right back after the week I drove it, and I says, hey, we went backwards by putting cheap tires on. So I spent 3 hours in the office the other day going around them, going on the Michelin calculator, and is that calculator based on 22.5 low pros?
Yeah.
Or okay, all right. Then,
so
yeah, I might even be 200 low resistance. I don't know.
Yeah, who
with
knows?
I don't know.
We know it's not good though.
Yeah, it's terrible. So okay, we're gonna buy new tires and wheels. And I've asked them to give me 22 low pros.
Right.
So I can drive at 55 to 58 miles an hour.
Would be perfect with the gear.
That's what I'm thinking. So I'll pick up, but now we're going over tires. And we went over whether we're going to put caps on, brand new tires, or go to a wide base tire.
Okay.
And what we did is we got with Brickstone 726s, we came up with 190,000 miles with brand new tires. Those tires were 177 rolling resistance.
Right. Okay?
Then we capped those tires after 190,000, and we went with Megatrax at 170 rolling resistance, and we got 150,000 miles out of those caps.
That's it?
How much? Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's horrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. He's finally starting to get it because I wouldn't leave the office until we got it all figured out. But the only thing we haven't really, we think we have it figured out, the cost between the 40,000 miles that we got on the newer tires than their caps. But I'm not sure if we're figuring it right. The caps cost $175. The new tire cost $400.
Right.
I mean, how much did we gain or lose in the new tire.
I wouldn't even buy. I mean, I could calculate that for you, and you were. The problem is you're comparing two tires that are so lousy that both strategies are bad. The way to calculate this would be to say, look, instead of running the 726 new, let's run an XDA Energy new. And now we're talking about savings in the several thousand dollars a year. Well, who cares what the tire costs?
Okay, the XD, I've got a list of four tires that we're looking at. A Recap Brigstone Fuel Tech at 118 rolling resistance. A new Brigstone M720 at 110 rolling resistance.
Yeah, that's a good choice too. I like that tire.
Okay, now we're going to go to the wide base. X1 XDA at 94 rolling resistance.
No, go to the new one, the Energy, at 86.
Okay, but see, the problem is we can't get any information on how long they're lasting.
Well, here's
what
I...
Do they last 100,000 miles or do they last 200,000 miles?
I just read on the forums on the website, somebody just got... And you know, I always take anything like this with a grain of salt, but I've got a lot of people that get a lot of miles out of their drive tires. I never do. So when I see these numbers, you know, I always think, really? Somebody on the website said they got almost 400,000 miles out of a set of XDA Energies.
Okay, I've heard that. I've talked to 60 drivers next to our office that come in with wide base tires. Some get 250,000, 300,000. Some have gotten up to 400,000. I talked to a Haney driver that's got 300,000, and they looked half wore out.
I know. I talked to many fleets before I switched to wide singles, and everybody. Minimum, they were getting 250,000 miles out of them.
Yeah. When I've talked to four fleets in the Northwest here, and the one company said with the XD1s, they were getting 100 to 150,000 on them.
Huh.
And the XD2s, XD1, X1, XDN2s, they're getting more mileage out of those tires.
Well, you do get more out of the XDN too, but again, what we come back to is that I care more about the fuel mileage than the life. And the XDN2 just doesn't do that great on fuel, even though it's a Michelin. If you're talking about the X1 XDN2, the wide single, I don't see the point. It's got a high rolling resistance, and again, we make, as long as fuel is above $2 a gallon, and right now we're at $3 a gallon, the life of the tire just doesn't matter to me. There's just not enough difference to ever make up the fuel cost savings. So I will always go with the lower rolling resistance and not even worry about what the life is going to be out of them. And somebody in the chat room wanted to know why I don't get high mileage out of my drives. It's because I run singles, and sure, I don't have any scuffing on singles, but all of the weight is on one axle, and all of the tire wear is on one axle instead of being spread across two. So, plus we get a lot of the whole wiggle effect out of the doubles, and I just think that, that's just been common for me. If I could ever get 200,000 miles out of a set of drive tires, I'd be really happy, and I get about 150 most of the time is what I count on. Let's go to Lance this time. Lance, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin? I was hearing you talk about those Freedom air filters. Or not Freedom, the...
Fleet air filters.
Fleet Guard. In the landscaping business, they've been using the pre-filters like that for some time. And when I was at the show, I noticed there were multiple companies offering something like that. And I'm surprised carriers haven't jumped on them beforehand. A pre-filter that would go over the element, the filter element, just to save on replacing them.
Yeah, I looked at one of those that was, in fact, I've got one right here that was designed to go over the Vortox cleaner on the outside. It's almost like a bonnet, like a wrap.
And I don't think that's a good idea myself. I like the ones that would fit over the element itself and
right.
go inside the cleaner.
Right. Well, one of the things we have to look at is what are we trying to accomplish? And for me, what I'm trying to accomplish is better airflow and better performance. So I'm not sure I would want to put something over my filter that might restrict airflow. If we're trying to extend the life of the filters, then that would make sense. I'm not seeing a problem of not enough filtration. What I mean is when we look at oil samples, silicon isn't a problem. So we're filtering the air just fine.
Every application has its cost. You have a guest here today in Florida with your Maggie. She's running dump trucks.
Right.
So if you were to put something like that over the element, you're running in quarries and whatnot picking up dust. Instead of replacing a $50 filter element, you have this piece that you could probably extend the filter element for, three, four times its life.
I bet you could. Yeah, you're right. In a severe duty, a dirty environment, that kind of thing, I think that might make sense to extend the life of the filter. I think it would. Now, on the other hand, did you look at the Fleet Air filter? Did you look at, and you see how thick that element is, like four different layers of foam?
Right, for over the road, I think that'd be good.
Well, actually, what we're looking at and what we're going to test, because my trucks never see dirt anywhere. I mean, we are always on pavement. And, so we really don't have any dirt. So we're looking at cutting that element in half because I've got such a clean environment. Why do I need that much filtration? We're going to try going with half that density, and then I'm just going to watch silicon levels and see if that helps. So you're right. We have to look at every different application. And, instead of the one size fits all that we've always done, which is throw in a paper filter, and when it gets clogged up, throw it away. And
that's the thing. When you talk to someone that works like severe duty, there's even over the road trucks that might go into mines.
Right.
And if you have something where you can extend that, the filter element change, I'm not even sure what an air filter costs nowadays. Probably $40.
You know what? I don't know what one costs either. I haven't paid attention to it in years. I just know my shop replaces them when they think they, it needs it. And I haven't looked at the cost, so I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. This is you. You're the guy that watches the cost on everything.
Some things I just trust my shop because I haven't paid attention to them. Air filter technology, I know. So now that's why I'm working on it now. How can we lower this cost? And why do we keep replacing this paper filter that the design on paper filters is horrible anyway? So, this is something I should be looking at. So now I'm looking at it.
Now, that's great. Well, that's all I had to say. I thought it was a great idea. They've been using it, like I said, in the landscape area for a long time, but they used to be little silly foam filters that would fit over a paper element that were oil covered to catch the dust. And in trucking, it just wouldn't work. And I seen three different vendors that had a cover that went over the current filter. But then I seen the Fleet, I guess it's Fleet Guard. Is that the washable one that you like now? Is that the three elements? Is it Fleet Guard or what's it called?
Just Fleet Air Filter is the name.
Fleet Air Filter. Is there a website for that?
Is it fleetairfilter.com? Is Lisa listening? She'll tell me what it is. It's fleetairfilter.com? Yes? No? Yes, that's what it is.
Well, we should try to check those out. That's the thing. I don't think a lot of drivers realize that's just one more filter, and if it's $40 to replace it, we should be watching it. And I've talked to guys. How often are you supposed to replace your air filter? Some guys say every quarter. Some guys say once a year. I don't know.
Well, and here's part of the problem. We talked about different operations, and nobody's really doing this the right way. It's fleetairfilters.com. That's what it is, with an S.
Filters.
Uh, And when you talk about an over the road, you're right. We have to specify. Somebody runs over the road primarily in the Southwest. There's a lot more dust there than there is in the Southeast or the Northwest. So even on on the highway all the time, we have different, you know, environments. And the problem with a paper filter is if you replace it too often, that might be good for airflow, but it's not so good for the engine. I've actually seen where we see increased silicon levels in the oil samples because when you first put that paper filter in, it's not very efficient at filtering. It needs to kind of get clogged up with dirt before it becomes efficient. So if we replace them too often, that's not good.
Mm-hmm. But that's a good idea. And I said, we'll look forward to seeing what it brings. And I hope you got some. You're going to put some of these on your truck so we can see the mileages on fuel gauges so we can track them?
Yep, absolutely.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Good talking to you. You know, the air filter technology, I think, has just been ignored. I think we're using the same technology we've been using for decades, and it doesn't do anything very well. Paper elements don't filter that well. When they clog up, then they don't flow that well. We have to replace them. It's just a stupid technology, and finally, somebody's looking at making something better. And like I say, you know, Fleet Air Filters is a small company. That's not their primary business. But, well, I'll tell you what, the guy that owns the company is so excited about the whole filter thing now. And that's what we need. We need really good people who understand that technology, whatever it is they're working on, and they have that passion. This guy gets so excited when we talk. He gets me excited about air filters. So I'm looking forward to working with him and coming up with some new ideas. Let's see. Hugh in Arizona, it's your turn. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. A couple of things. The one element about the paper air filters that I'm not even sure really is a factor, but I had a company, a trucking company shop manager once tell me they change their filters every 36,000 miles, whether they need it or not. And I asked him, I said, wow, that seems like an unnecessary expense. Now, I don't know how much confidence I have in this guy's knowledge, but what he said is that if you leave an air filter in too long, it will be, well, even if it stays clean, it'll begin to deteriorate. And you don't want those paper fibers being ingested into your air intake system.
Well, that's
the only person I ever heard say that, but I don't know if there's anything to that or not.
Well, paper can deteriorate. 36,000 miles is really soon, I think. I think they are. The two things wrong with that. One, I think they're just wasting money. And two, like I said, a new paper element is actually not all that great for the engine because they don't filter very well. But he's correct in that. That is another downside to paper. It deteriorates. So that's kind of my point about why are we still using this lousy technology that's been around for decades and we haven't improved on it?
Yeah. An update on my Davco fuel filter. I spoke to you a couple of weeks ago about thinking I was having to replace it because it was operating very badly. And when we took it apart, we found metal shavings and things in there. Well, what we did, just as a temporary measure, was just clean it up, get all the metal shavings out, make sure the O-ring was in good shape, and put it back together. I have not had one bit of problem with my fuel system since then. I haven't had a problem with it losing prime. I haven't had a problem with it not wanting to start or anything. And I talked to another mechanic that I have a lot of confidence in. He said what they've been seeing a lot on newer trucks is aluminum shaving in the Davco filters. And the only thing he can figure is there's something that they're mishandling when they install the fuel tanks at the factory, that there's some – he said the only place you get aluminum from in the fuel system is the tank.
Right.
And that apparently there's some aluminum shavings in the fuel tank from the factory.
and it's showing up in the filter, which is a good thing. That's what it's there for, to stop that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, but I guess it just got to be so much and stayed in there for so long in mine that it began to affect the operation of the filter. But it seems to be working great now. I'm not even thinking about replacing it because it's working so well now.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah, I think so too. It's just to tip somebody else who might be having a similar problem. Just take it apart and clean it up real good.
Good.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, a friend of mine, he drives I think it's probably an 03 or an 04, maybe an 05, I forget, Freightliner Classic with a Caterpillar engine. I don't know exactly which engine he's got in it. But he listens to your show on XM. I don't think he's gotten into the podcast. And he was wanting to know, he drives that thing, you know, it's a big old classic, and he drives at the speed limit, and he just doesn't want to even try slowing down.
Right.
And his question is, I do all the things Kevin says, you know, as far as rolling resistance on tires and air tabs and all the other products that Kevin promotes to help fuel economy. Can I get a return of investment on those if I don't slow down?
You know, we would have to look at each one individually. And I almost hate to say this because I'd rather somebody just slow down first.
Absolutely.
There's so many reasons to do that. It's free. It's less stressful once you get used to it. It's safer. It's easier on the truck. It's easier on the engine. We don't have to worry about tickets. I mean, there's so many benefits.
Easier on the driver, too.
Right, right. So I hesitate to tell people that some of the things we talk about actually show a bigger improvement at higher speeds. And some things, though, it's the opposite. Some things really aren't going to matter if you're going to run that fast. Tire rolling resistance actually changes with speed. The impact isn't as great when we get to higher speeds. Aerodynamics are the opposite. They become more important if we're not going. Yeah, exactly. Exponentially. So talk about running 75 miles an hour. If you take a fully aerodynamic truck and compare it to a classic, your spread is going to be bigger at 75 than it is at 55. So products like air tabs would become more important at 75 or 70 miles an hour than they are at 55. High performance stuff, you know, high flow manifolds, mufflers, becomes more important because we're running the engine so much harder. And so there are some things that...
Oh, there's a lot more airflow required
exactly.
to maintain those speeds. So if you can cut out on the resistance there, you're bound to pick up an appreciable improvement.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I hesitate to put a Pittsburgh power box on my trucks, even though I know how much better it is for the engine performance. I don't think I'm demanding enough out of my engines that it's going to matter. But if you're out running 70 or 75 miles an hour, it's going to make a huge difference. So I think the answer to his question, most of the stuff we talk about, it would actually show possibly a bigger return on investment because of the speed.
Okay. Well, I'll pass that answer on to him. Have him listen to the podcast.
But like I say, I hate to promote that kind of stuff because I'd rather just see somebody take the first step is really to slow down. So many benefits. I'm all out of time. This just flew by tonight. Thanks for joining me. 30 minutes from now, we'll be live on SiriusXM, so check us out there. Chat room's up and running in on the website, and we'll see you soon. Thanks, everybody. Remember, be safe, be profitable, be responsible, and master the journey. Good night. I'm Kevin Rutherford.